The idea of analytic neutrality, which was a more or less a cliche truth when I was training back in the 1980s, the idea of neutrality is clearly getting at something very important, which is that we mustn't try to preconceive where the patient's development is going to take him or her. But that doesn't mean that the development is not in a direction. Aristotle famously said that the human being is a zoon politikon, a creature who belongs in a somewhat structured society. And healthy development is in that sort of direction. As we become more integrated, as our ghosts become more like ancestors, to use that famous metaphor, we become more aware of the reality of other people and their real, as opposed to their fantasied, importance in the ecosystem of which we are all part. And this makes possible the sort of ethical realization that Levinas was talking about. We recognize the reality of the other. We discover that we are interconnected. We are part of something that is hugely greater than ourselves and that goes beyond our knowing. But of course, that doesn't mean that we are not also our selfish and unique selves. It's that we are under pressure, so to speak, from both quarters.
Welcome to the IPA podcast, Psychoanalysis on and off the couch. This podcast consists of conversations with psychoanalysts from around the world who share with us their clinical and psychoanalytic work with individuals both on and off the couch. And what we mean by off the couch is that they share with us their community involvement in many different venues apart from their consultation rooms. They describe their work in hospitals, in community clinics, in refugee centers, in classrooms, indeed in war zones. We also have conversations with psychoanalysts who are focusing their work on the couch, and they are continuing to refine both our familiar and novel understandings of the dynamic mind as it presents itself in the analytic situation. Please visit our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can subscribe, where you can see the recommended readings provided by our guests, and you can also leave a comment. I hope you enjoy these conversations and find them thoughtful and meaningful, and I appreciate your listening. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is David Black. David Black is a psychoanalyst who, prior to that, was a pastoral counselor and studied philosophy and Eastern religions before he began his training in London. He is a fellow of the British Psychoanalytical Society, now retired, and he's written widely on psychoanalysis in relation to matters of ethics and religion. In 2006, he edited Psychoanalysis and Religion in the 21st Century, and he has published two collections of his own psychoanalytic papers. Most recently, and this is the focus of our attention today, his most recent book, Psychoanalysis and Ethics, The Necessity of Perspective. In addition, David is a poet and a translator whose translation of Dante's Purgatorio was published in 2021 in the New York Review of Books Classics series, and it was later the winner of the annual American National Translation Award in Poetry. Our conversation today focuses on Freud's view. We begin with Freud's view of religion, and David offers what he feels is an alternative to that through the medium of allegorical objects, that is, not endowing God and gods with literalness, but seeing them importantly allegorical and providing a foundation for what he calls ethical seriousness. It also offers the opportunity to appreciate transcendence, all of which we spend time speaking about. He brings forward Emmanuel Levinas, and he feels that Levinas has a great deal to say about psychoanalysis and religion, and in particular, responsibility. Levinas was a prisoner of war in World War II, And he quotes Levinas. I'll just mention one of them, where he says, there is a paradox in responsibility. And by this, he's referring to responsibility, what he calls in the face of the other, that is, in relation to another person. There is a paradox in responsibility in that I am obliged, without this obligation having begun in me, as though an order slipped into my consciousness like a thief. There's much to be said about that, of course, and David represents this thinking very well. He also closes with his own personal story and how such influences, which are in all of us, contributed to his simultaneous interest in both religion and psychoanalysis. It is my pleasure to share with you my conversation with David Black. David, welcome to the podcast. So glad you're with us. David, as you know, the conversation between psychoanalysis and religion has been famously longstanding and probably equally famously contentious. And among the many voices who speak in this conversation, I have to say that I have found your voice to be one of the more reasoned of the many. And I think it's because you are both intellectually and emotionally grounded in both of these worldviews. And in that spirit, in your recent book entitled Psychoanalysis and Ethics, The Necessity of Perspective, Perspective Indeed, you bring forward, among other voices, but especially that of Emmanuel Levinas, who is an increasingly well-known 20th century French philosopher, who many feel has much to say to both the world of psychoanalysis and religion. To start us off, I'd like to jump into a few sentences you've written in the book that represent your view of Freud's view of religion, and from there work our way through parts of your book representing how you view it in contrast as an alternative to Freud's view. And you bring up your idea of allegorical objects, which we will spend time on, and then we will land on Emmanuel Levinas and see what he has to teach us. So to begin, you write, Freud sees religion from the standpoint of an ego that is defending itself against disturbance. Sort of the ego saying, I am frightened by the recognition of my helplessness, in a big world by the world of unpredictability, and by the fact of my own inescapable death and the deaths of those I love and depend upon. Religion is compellingly attractive, therefore, because it gives me a way to think I don't have to fear these things. They may be realities in this world, but the fairy tales of religion allow me to believe there is another, truer world in which they are not realities. The ego need not be so disturbed. It can return to its state of rest. Very succinctly said. Now, in contrast, you introduce the notion of religious objects, and you begin the sharing of your alternative view of religion, and you say, religious objects can be understood as ultimately allegorical in nature, that far from being merely illusion, they have a perfectly recognizable function from a social and ethical point of view, which is educational. Emotional and educational education has traditionally been one of the central functions of religions. The discrediting of religion in the eyes of so many educated people in our society has resulted in an enormous void in our thinking, which until recently has gone almost unnoticed. David, you want to start us off?
Okay. Well, I've used quite a bit the notion of allegorical objects to describe the sort of things religious objects are. Religious objects meaning gods, demons, bodhisattvas, angels. So I think of those as allegorical. And in a sense, in the past, I think there was much more acceptance of the possibility of what I mean by allegorical objects. But in the past few centuries, as science came to seem to many like the one source of truth, so too religions have increasingly started reading their scriptures in the same sort of way, as if their scriptures are the single source of truth, what we call fundamentalism in Christianity. But this sort of literal-mindedness has affected all the major religions, or certainly all of them except Buddhism, perhaps. Allegory is the alternative to this literal-minded approach. It's the poetic reading of religious language. And essentially, it describes a use of language that knows that the truth can't quite be got into language, but it can be pointed to. All teachings are just fingers pointing at the moon, say the Buddhists. And I've done quite a bit of work recently on Dante translating his Divine Comedy. And that, of course, is a supreme example of allegorical thought. And it ends at the very final canto of Paradiso with the most wonderful and rich discussion of what Christianity means by the mystery of incarnation, how God can be met in another human being. And it puts it in terms of Christ and the Virgin Mary, obviously. But Dante realizes that although he can talk about it, and he can say many things that are very moving about it, and it's enormously important, but he absolutely cannot understand it. And in this final canto, he wrestles with that fact. And finally, he has a breakthrough, which is no longer seeing things in terms of religious objects at all, but seeing things in terms of love as the ultimate value.
Let me read something you've written about allegorical objects, and then I want to ask you a question about, you made a linkage between how scientists view their data and how the religious view their scriptures. But to read this first, you say, if we define an allegorical object as one that embodies an important value and is also encountered as a unique subject that awakens his or her motive in me, then religious objects are best understood as a species or class of allegorical objects. In Christianity, the issue has been confused by the intense preoccupation with believing in religious objects, believing being construed as refusing to distinguish between objects in the external and internal worlds. You go on to say, to be required to believe as historically factual things that are incompatible with one's rational understanding of how the world works is intimidating and infantilizing and bound to create psychic incoherence. This emphasis on believing is less present in other religions, for example, Judaism, where what is emphasized is more the observance of certain requirements of behavior. Levinas used to say about Judaism, belief is not a primary issue, and hardly at all in Buddhism, you go on to say, where mythological entities are regularly described as mental constructs. Now, there's a lot in that, and we're going to take up the issue of belief, but did I understand you correctly to say that it is best to review religious objects, like you say, gods, etc., as allegorical objects, in the same way that scientists would be best to encounter their data as allegorical?
I don't think I want to say that. The psychoanalyst that I've found myself repeatedly returning to in writing this book is Hans Löwald. And what he introduced into psychoanalysis was the fact that there can be many different standpoints from which we view the truth. Freud was still very much caught up in the 19th century picture of science, that science gave us a picture of reality and nothing else did. And therefore, religion, for example, could be confidently dismissed as illusion. But our science, said Freud, is no illusion. And I think Löwald would probably agree that our science is not an illusion. But what he makes room for is that we can have a different sort of posture in relation to our experience and to the universe. I mean, the example that comes to mind is when he's talking about the death drive, and you quoted from some of what I said about that earlier on, and he says that essentially the death drive is a version of the constancy principle that Freud had acquired from Fechner and had always used. And his picture was then that the psyche really wants to return to its state of rest and not be bothered. Primary narcissism is our primary condition in Freud's picture. And Lowald doesn't want to say that has no reality. It certainly does have a reality. But we might also have another point of view from which we view more complex psychic organization and the capacity for relationships and the capacity to play a part in society as being just as true as the picture that Freud was dealing with.
And you make that point very well in this next section I wanted to read, where you say certain allegorical objects, like Levinas's face of the other, embody values felt to be of transcendent, commanding importance. When such objects are affirmed and validated in a specific cultural tradition, they are described as religious. At this point, the language of positivist science ceases to be illuminating. If a reductive 19th century materialism is our metaphysics, there can be no transcendent values. The compelling power of such objects can only be attributed to illusion, to some fantasy derivable from sex or power. Any transcendent ethical claim can only be illusion, conscience can only be a superego, and seeing the face of the other, a concept that we're going to get to in a moment, may give rise to affect, but cannot give rise to command. And I understand this to be a central point of your book, that if everything is just what it is, then the possibility of transcendence is absent. Do I reduce that too far, or is that a fair characterization?
I'm happy with that as a characterization. Yeah.
Okay. At the same time, let me ask, certainly deep thinking scientists often will describe their work in quite transcendent poetic terms, the beauty, the majesty, the magic of the world, the order, the physics, the math. So that maybe they don't lose the transcendence. What do you think?
Well, I think many scientists have not lost the transcendence. I think the end of the 19th century was a peculiarly difficult time because science was being so successful in so many spheres, including obviously Darwin's evolution and many other things, were suddenly being presented to us. So I think science seemed as though it was sweeping all before it at that time. And Freud often speaks as though that's his picture as well in his Weltanschauung paper, for example. My understanding, just to come back to Levinas, my understanding of Levinas's thought is that he makes room for something that modern rationality has really got no place for. The fact that ethical values have a commanding quality, and that's his word, commanding. Most modern philosophy, certainly in the Anglo-American world, has tended to say that values are at best matters of taste or matters of some kind of utilitarian calculation of consequences, to which the skeptic obviously is free to respond by saying, well, so what? I don't care about that, whatever it is. But for Levinas, the command is not a matter of my agreeing to it. When I meet the face of the other, to use his famous phrase, when I meet the face of the other, I experience the command to be responsible towards the other. And Levinas was a Holocaust survivor. His entire family of origin had been murdered in the Holocaust, and his wife only survived in anti-Semitic France, thanks to a community of Christian nuns. And so when he talked about ethics and its crucial importance, he's speaking out of an enormously powerful experience. He knew that there were some people for whom it was true that their ethical commitment was their primary reality, so to speak. They were willing to take enormous risks in order to do what they felt was the right thing. And he speaks of ethics as first philosophy. That's one of his famous article titles, Ethics as First Philosophy. And he absolutely means that and perceives it as the result of this experience, not as a result of some kind of calculation or thinking.
And we're going to get to the section where you make very clear his embrace, may not be the best word, of ethics and how central and obligatory it is, as opposed to psychologically derived. But then you take us in the direction of what does this have to do with psychoanalysis? And you say, the changes that develop in psychoanalysis have a necessarily ethical tendency. This is not the result of moralistic intentions on the part of the analyst, but is the necessary result of the nature of psychic integration. Psychoanalysis moves us towards increased recognition of the reality of others and towards a broadening of the range of our understanding and sympathy. Let me read that again because it's so key. Psychoanalysis moves us towards increased recognition of the reality of others and towards a broadening of the range of our understanding and sympathy. I'm inclined to think that this is a secret hidden in plain sight in our profession, but it has been concealed or scotomized ever since Freud used his metaphor of the impartial surgeon to describe the psychoanalyst. It has left psychoanalysts with a wish to assure us that they have no goals for the patient or no wish to do anything but analyze the patient. It is rather like saying, I have a mill, so I grind corn. Don't ask me what I grind corn for. And I think the result of our clinical work, when it goes well, is that the person discovers the other, often to their pleasure and often, of course, to their disappointment. But at least it's a more authentic, affectively alive experience of the other and all the exigencies of object relations that are associated with that. And you're having that be a bridge to Levinas's notion of ethics and indeed maturity. Do I have that right?
Yes. I mean, the idea of analytic neutrality, which was a more or less a cliche truth when I was training back in the 1980s, the idea of neutrality is clearly getting at something very important, which is that we mustn't try to preconceive where the patient's development is going to take him or her. But that doesn't mean that the development is not in a direction. Aristotle famously said that the human being is a zoon politikon, a creature who belongs in a somewhat structured society. And healthy development is in that sort of direction. As we become more integrated, as our ghosts become more like ancestors, to use that famous metaphor, we become more aware of the reality of other people and their real, as opposed to their fantasied, importance in the ecosystem of which we are all part. And this makes possible the sort of ethical realization that Levinas was talking about. We recognize the reality of the other. We discover that we are interconnected. We are part of something that is hugely greater than ourselves and that goes beyond our knowing. But of course, that doesn't mean that we are not also our selfish and unique selves. It's that we are under pressure, so to speak, from both quarters.
Beautifully put. Let's talk a little bit more about Levinas. And let me ask you to read a section at the bottom of page 108 to describe a bit about him, and then I will continue on from there.
Yes. As I said a moment ago, he survived the Holocaust very remarkably as a prisoner of the German military. And after the war, he produced a succession of philosophical works in which he looked with great sensitivity at issues of ethics, which he declared to be first philosophy, of prior importance and known with greater certainty than ontologies such as the natural sciences. And he developed above all his notion of the face of the other, meaning, of course, not the literal face, but something more like the poignant human reality of the other, which, once it's seen, is perceived to be the source of a command, an obligation of responsibility in relation to the other. And he sometimes phrases that obligation in traditional Jewish terms as the commandment, thou shalt not kill. And this command is transcendent in his language. It is infinite. It cannot be denied, though it can be ignored, and it cannot be accounted for. It's self-validating. Its call to respond singles out me as the unique person I am. Me who am me and no one else, as Levinas puts it. The uniqueness of the I consists in the fact that nobody can respond in its place. That's the nature of this ethical command to responsibility. No one can respond in my place. By obeying the call of responsibility for the other, one becomes human, in Levinas's language. Humanity is an achievement in Levinas's conception. It's not given merely by belonging to a biological species.
You know, when I read that sentence you quoted, the uniqueness of the I consists in the fact that nobody can respond in its place, I'm reminded of the phenomena that every analytic dyad is unique, and they discover the inner life of the analysand, but they discover it in a way that only these two people can discover it. And it seems like that is a bridge from the uniqueness of the I. But you go on to write, Levinas always insisted on the transcendence of obligation. It was not an emotion. Obligation is present regardless of one's emotions, nor was he doing psychology. Levinas doesn't speculate about the psychological background of ethical compellingness as a psychoanalyst is bound to do. For example, Chetri Vatine, an analyst, like Freud in 1895, links the origin of ethics back to the initial helplessness of the infant. Freud had understood that the adult wish to help the infant is based on an unconscious memory in the adult of having once been comparably helpless herself. And this gives a basis to identify with the child's need and therefore to wish to help him. And she goes on to describe, and you quote, this being a matricial space. Help us with that.
Well,
it's a lot to ask. Is that what you're like?
It takes me back to the Virgin Mary, I think.
Go ahead. We can go there.
I may land up there. Who knows? But Chetri Vatine uses that phrase, matricial space. Matrice is the French for the womb. So matricial space is like a psychological version of the womb. It exists only to give space for development and makes no demands on the fetus or the baby to adapt to it. What Chetri Vatine is describing, using that phrase, is the psychological space the mother opens up to the newborn baby so that it can feel safe to be a true self, in Winnicott's phrase, and not feel that it has to split off parts of itself in order to adapt to the requirements or the limitations of the parents and the people around it. Winnicott, I think, gets at the same sort of idea, but rather less specifically, when he speaks of the ordinary devoted mother, the ordinary devotion, so to speak, of the mother. But matricial space, I think, is a good phrase, and Chetri Vatine explicitly links it with Levinas's thought. It's an ethical space. It's governed by the ethical requirement of the mother to give that kind of space to her newborn child.
Let me add to our conversation. I have heard analysts, thoughtful analysts, register complaint with the what they feel is the wholesale adoption of Levinas's ways of thinking to analytic ways of thinking, with the unhappiness that it seems to ask for a unidirectional engagement. That is, that little is asked of the person receiving this ethical spirit from the other, and that it doesn't honor the fact that there's energy and thought and communication going in both directions, which interestingly, going back to that science you referred to before, Recent science actually evidences that the matricial space using the uterus, the in utero experience, is far more nuanced than just this inert fetus being cared for by the mother. That in fact, there is communication of a biochemical sort, undoubtedly, but there is communication where each impacts the other. And so certainly true for the newborn. The same mother relates differently to X number of newborns because newborns are also sending out signals of various sorts. So is that a challenge, a reasonable challenge in your view to the Levinas's commandment, commitment? I don't know if burden is the right word, but his one directionalness.
Yes, it's a very interesting question that. And there's a very interesting story that Derrida told at Levinas's funeral. Derrida was a great admirer of Levinas. And he told a story at the funeral of a conversation he'd once had with Levinas, in which Levinas had said to him, "You know, people talk about what I write as ethics, but to be truthful, I'm not only interested in ethics. What I'm really interested in is," and he used the word sainteté, which might be translated sanctity or holiness, which are words that probably most of us are rather uncomfortable with nowadays. But that's what he said. And I think what he's indicating there is that he's not talking about the same level of ethics as, say, Aristotle was, or I think the sort of psychoanalytic critic that you're describing now. He's describing, to quote someone else, Simon Critchley, a philosopher, he said that Levinas is talking about a primary existential commitment on which all other ethical thinking is built. And I think that would be the answer to the kind of psychoanalytic critic that you're describing, that the psychoanalyst is necessarily and rightly concerned with interactions and the ambiguities and differences of people and so forth. But Levinas is trying to speak about what they're founded on. It's his response to the face of the other, I think, is the foundation stone of the ethical structure. I mean, there was an embarrassing moment once when he was interviewed on the French radio after the massacres at Chatila, and I think it was called Sabra, the other place, back in the 1980s. And he couldn't bring himself to condemn what had happened. And many people, like Judith Butler, have been very critical of Levinas for somehow letting Israel off the hook. And Levinas said, perhaps a rather weak defense in the circumstances, but he said, there are different issues here. Everybody has the face of the other, including one's brothers and one's family members. They too are others with their own face and requiring their own commitment. And there's another level of ethical discussion, which he described as politics, where you have to make decisions about which ethical demand you're going to respond to, etc. So it's a complicated picture, as it were, above the simplicity of the face of the other.
Certainly it is more involved than simplicity. And when it comes to politics, just to close that reference you made, there were, in fact, hearings about the violence that you were referring to in the political realm, and people paid a price for it. So we're talking about philosophy now. Politics is certainly more complicated in its own way. Let's pick up on the bottom of page 117, and this continues your thought about the triumphs of science and the cost of that.
Okay. the spectacular triumphs of science and materialism in the past two centuries, together with the widespread rejection of religion and allegorical ways of thinking, have tended to deprive educated people of any words in which to speak of this love of being and this transcendent level of ethics. Psychoanalysis, too, has found it difficult to speak of. The moral chaos of recent public life, the destruction of nature, and the rise of populism and authoritarianism all around the globe are perhaps in part a consequence of this failure and absence of vocabulary. It's a matter of considerable importance to rediscover a language in which these issues can be thought about.
Which leads into the next chapter entitled Religion as the Affirmation of Values and the interface with psychoanalysis. And you write, in psychoanalytic practice, there was no question that ethical values were taken seriously. There was the foundational value of one's duty to one's patient, and in Kleinian thought especially, there were the many concerns with value that are summed up in speaking of the oscillation between paranoid, schizoid, and depressive positions. The perceptions of others in our rather clumsy vocabulary as part objects or whole objects. But there was a serious void in psychoanalysis. Aside from the superego, there was no basis in theory for ethical values. They were taken very seriously in practice. The ethical commitment of psychoanalysts was, in general, very impressive. But there was no way the theory could account for the values that were so clearly embodied in the practice of the best practitioners. It reminded me that back a century ago now in the psychoanalytic literature, there were conversations about that it wasn't what the analyst said that was clinically valuable, but who the analyst was, which one could unpack in many ways, but seems to have a link to your comment about the ethical standards, practice, and commitment of the analyst is a key part. You don't go on to say that it's a key part of therapeutics, but it sounds like you mean that. And it's picking up that old adage about who the analyst is. Do you think that's fair to say?
Yes. I think the importance of the specific relationship, you mentioned how unique psychoanalytic relationships are. The importance of that relationship, I think, is the medium in which psychoanalysis has its effect. I thought I might just say one thing about the superego, because I think that's an important element here, because that was the, for many years anyway, the kind of principal notion that psychoanalysts seem to have about the origin of ethical values, the idea of the superego, the idea of the values of others imported into the ego in the course of development, which again is certainly something that's very real. We often meet those imported values in patients. And Ron Britton, for example, the psychoanalyst in my country, has written about the need to emancipate oneself from the superego. And people sometimes translate the superego as conscience, as if the word superego and the word conscience mean the same thing. But a conscience, as I understand it, is very different. It's what recognizes one's own values, the values one doesn't want to be emancipated from, but to endorse and to embody. One might say that Levinas's seeing the face of the other awakens the conscience in this second sense.
I think that's a very important point. I don't know if you're familiar with the work of Don Carvath from Canada. I've interviewed twice, actually, and he writes quite extensively on just these points about the missing concern for the other in the traditional analytic model of the superego, and where is the concern for the other. And interestingly, he factors in his own relationship to Christianity in his, I don't want to speak too much for him because he can certainly represent himself, his own way of thinking, but he sees that as an aspect of appreciating the concern for the other. Let me stop there. The episodes are worth listening to, as is his book. most recent book, I believe, is called Guilt, which leads us to responsibility. And you write, speaking of Levinas and his history of being in a prisoner of war camp during the war and his family being murdered, a family with such a history was unlikely to be impressed with the argument that ethical values were based on illusion or were merely a matter of taste. He took responsibility as his central theme, and his writings, often extremely difficult but always remarkably penetrating, return again and again to the notion of responsibility. And you go on to quote him as saying, "When I behold you," or in Levinas's language, "when I see the face of the other, I recognize the force of the commandment, thou shalt not kill. I become aware of responsibility. Quote, in its expression, in its morality, the face before me summons me," he wrote, "as if the invisible death must be faced by the other were my business." And later he says, quote, "There is a paradox in responsibility in that I am obliged, without this obligation having begun in me, as though an order slipped into my consciousness like a thief." That's quite something. "Like an order slipped into my consciousness like a thief," almost as if we are genetically hardwired, which indeed we may be. What do you think?
Well, I'm happy to go along with what Levinas says there. I think it's one of these wonderfully evocative passages that he comes up with. And yes, I do think we are hardwired. I mean, I find that phrase of Aristotle, zoon politikon, which may be a little bit tedious to repeat it, but I do find that an extraordinarily fertile way to think about human beings. And it, of course, Aristotle has a notion of final cause, that we are not just influenced by past causes that are pressing us onward into the future, but we are also drawn by a state of maturity that awaits us. The acorn is awaited by the oak tree into which it will grow, so to speak. And the phrase zoon politikon does suggest that we are necessarily part of society. So that responsibility to the other is absolutely hardwired, yes.
And that's or exists in sharp distinction from a notion that thou shalt not kill is merely reaction formation, which is an entirely different enterprise than what you and I are speaking of now.
Yes, I think so. I think so. It also has a sort of superego-ish quality.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. Now, you, in this chapter, offer yourself as an interlocutor. You write, "Why isn't it enough just to have whatever values one has as a result of one's personal epiphanic moments and one's personal history of human relations? How can there be a role for religion in the eyes of an intelligent person who can see, like Freud or like Richard Dawkins, how often the narratives and objects of religion are used by believers to provide false or infantile consolation, or to generate fantasies of specialness, chosenness, and rightness, which all too often merely give further justification for attitudes of exclusion and group conflict? Why should we not just stay with our values, recognizing now that they are objective or even transcendent, and put all religious baggage behind us?" And before I invite you to summarize your two answers to your question, I want to acknowledge that among the many things I learned in reading your book, I have never heard of epiphany being turned into an adjective in the form of epiphanic. So I thank you for that piece of knowledge. Now, you have two answers to the question, why don't we leave religious baggage behind? You want to share with our listeners your answers?
Yes, I'll try to. It's difficult because actual religions, the actual religions as practiced, so often seem to emphasize their mythology more than their ethics. And of course, the Christian church has its creed, which appears to be the central statement of what everybody in the Christian church believes. So that emphasizes even more strongly the belief aspect of the whole thing. So that emphasizes the mythology more than the ethical values. And that can be stultifying, and as we see with fundamentalism, can be actively dangerous. But nevertheless, there are many responsible religious people who do hold on to ethical seriousness, and that can be immensely important, as we've seen with people like, I hope I'm free to mention one or two more political figures, Nelson Mandela, Desmond Tutu, Martin Luther King, and so on. These are people who have a religious commitment, but absolutely holding on to their ethical values. And sometimes, even when serious thinkers repudiate religion, like Freud, but affirm ethical values, it may turn out that they've been deeply influenced by a history of having been close to someone religious. Freud's father, for example, was very religious. Winnicott came from a strong Methodist background. Jonathan Lear suggests that Hans Lowald had a profound religious commitment. It seems to me that we need religion in some form because we need a community that affirms the values we recognize when we see the face of the other. We may, in that moment, epiphanic moment, we may recognize them vividly, but we are easily distracted, we easily forget them, or we are taken over then by other emotions or preoccupations. And so we need a context that reminds us of them. One of the chapters in my book is entitled Religion as the Affirmation of Values. And that, I think, is its fundamental and essential function. And I mentioned, you quoted it earlier on, the educational function of traditional religions. And I think ordinary religion in the past very often had a very important function in educating people in thinking about ethical issues, quite independently of the mythological stuff. And that, with the willingness of educated people to just leave religion behind, to grow out of religion, as Winnicott once put it, I think that overlooked this educational function. And there's been a considerable void. And again, when you look around at the sort of ethical chaos of the modern world, I think one may think that that has something to do with it.
When I first read your first answer to your question about why not leave religion behind, and your answer is that, well, you may leave it behind, but you are nevertheless under the influence of recent generations who were religious, who had an impact on you that you may not be aware of. I was both sort of taken by that, hadn't occurred to me. But then I also thought about it and I said, well, but that would be true for any phenomena at this point in history. I mean, scientists have religious people one or two generations ago. Criminals have religious people one or two. It doesn't quite match up by finding the thread that we admire being principled and say, aha, you may not be principled because of religion, but two generations ago, there was a religious person, that kind of thing. So that was a question I had about it. But to develop your second point, you go on to say, how am I to remember my values and continue to be influenced by them, even in non-epiphanic moments, even at times when my attention is necessarily elsewhere or when other motives like fear or self-preoccupation may be in the ascendant? You write, it is to this question that the answer may be religion, which you put in quotation marks here, with its teachings, practices, and institutional arrangements. Every religion finds a way to affirm its values by presenting them in connection with stories, with personalities, with rituals and ceremonies, with artworks and music, with practices that have the function of reminding the believer of its foundational values and arousing the emotions that affirm the values. And when I read that, what immediately came to my mind was, well, by those criteria, would not psychoanalysis pass the test of being a religion? That is, we certainly have specific practices and rituals. There are ethical commitments. We certainly have storied personalities in our pasts. There's a lengthy immersion in study and initiation. And in terms of the central point, of deeply knowing another. There is perhaps no other human endeavor that allows such an experience. So what do you think?
Yes, it's an interesting question that I actually don't want to say that psychoanalysis is a religion. It's a psychotherapy, and its goal is to bring the patient to a point of making his own decisions about his values and his life. Jonathan Lear uses the word freedom to describe what psychoanalysis is moving towards, to free the person to make their own decisions. But psychoanalytic theory, as opposed to psychoanalytic practice, psychoanalytic theory may have a destiny that's different from therapy. It's developed in this odd intellectual isolation in institutions and training organizations, which are often separate from the wider world of philosophy and the universities. And I think its future, if it is to have a fertile future, will require it to create or reestablish links of that sort. And of course, I think in turn, philosophy needs to hear from psychoanalysis. Its emphasis on how we are shaped by our earliest pre-verbal experience is something that's still missing from a lot of philosophical thought.
Indeed. David, before I ask you a bit about your personal story, can I ask you to read your final paragraph of the book, which sums up much of what you're trying to communicate in this writing?
This is the final chapter of...
The 145, chapter. The bottom of 145, yeah.
Yeah, right. Well, I've said this then is Levinasian religion. The chapter is about his picture of religion. It isn't about believing six impossible things before breakfast. It's about perceiving the infinity of the other and about hearing the call to responsibility that emanates from it. The stories told by religion may be fictional, but religion is not adequately described as illusion. Historically, it has played a fundamental role in preserving the language of ethical seriousness, which is essential if individuals are to find their lives meaningful, and if the cardinal institutions of civil society, including the affirmation of human rights, the rule of law, and respect for nature and the world's ecosystems, are to be maintained over long periods of time. This role is ultimately the reason for religion's importance. Levinas's argument singles out this role. It does not answer the many further questions of how ethical seriousness will be expressed in practice in terms of actual decisions and actions. Such questions involve practical knowledge, self-management, and the wisdom born of experience.
Thank you for that. The wisdom born of experience. That as a segue to David, there aren't many analysts who have immersed themselves in these two worlds. Can you share with us how you got to where you are now?
I mean, I think in good psychoanalytic fashion, I was formed by my earliest experiences. I was born at the start of World War II in 1941, shortly before the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor and brought America into the war, etc. It still looked entirely possible that Hitler was going to win the war. And my mother was on her own, living the life of a refugee in a country where she knew nobody. And there must be many people with echoes of this experience today. But this was in South Africa, and many South Africans in those days supported the Nazis. My father had come to Europe in the British Army. He was involved with that, and it was 4 years before she saw him again and must have had every expectation that he would be killed and she would not see him again. I think she was intensely anxious and frightened, and at the same time very hurt and angry to be left alone halfway through a pregnancy. And when I arrived, she could produce no milk, and she refused to settle anywhere. In those 4 years, we lived in at least four different towns around different parts of the country, and she formed no lasting friendships. So in my construction of my experience, which she was always very reluctant to talk about, but in my construction of my experience, what Shetri Vatin calls the matricial space was a complicated area. And I won't go on with the story, but issues of values, issues of ethics were always a problem for me. How should one respond to love or to opportunity? On what basis should one make decisions? These were the questions I found myself asking, which took me ultimately into my own analysis and into the themes I've written about here.
All I can say is thank you, David. Thank you for writing your thoughts, for sharing your struggle with us, really, because that's what I experienced the book as. It's not a book with easy answers, because it wouldn't be worth its weight if it pretended to have easy answers. But you engage the struggle as honestly as one can, to my ears, and that you bring forward your emotional context from your past, which we all do in everything we do, deepens for me the authenticity of your struggle. So thank you for putting it down in words, and thank you for sharing your words with our listeners. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much for many generous remarks in the course of this interview. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.